Do you think it's true that we really only get one chance to make a first impression? Maybe. But then again, isn't it also true that we shouldn't judge a book by its cover? Who hasn't had the experience of making a snap judgment and being right? And who hasn't had the experience of making a snap judgment based on a first impression, only to realize later how really off base that initial first response turned out to be? Several years ago, author Malcolm Gladwell was back on the bestseller list with his book Blink, a book about first impressions and snap judgments. He begins with the book with a gripping description of how the Getty Museum in Los Angeles spent 14 months meticulously examining a 6th-century Grecian sculpture, which they then purchased for $10 million. Their legal department had thoroughly researched the history of the sculpture. Geologists and scientists had studied it with X-ray diffraction and electron microprobes, and the museum's curator of antiquities proclaimed it authentic. And then, just before the purchase, the curator of the Getty showed the sculpture to the former director of the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. And as the curator removed the cloth covering the sculpture, the first word that came to the former director's mind was fresh. And fresh, he thought, was not the right response to something 2,000 years old. Other art historians had similar reactions, what they called instinctual hunches, that something was not quite right, including one museum director who said just looking at it made him feel cold. Today, according to Blink, the statue is pictured in the Getty's catalog with a notation saying about 530 BC or modern forgery. The book is filled with examples that show how instant gut decisions can be just as good as decisions made cautiously and deliberately and after great consideration. Gladwell believes it all comes down to learning how to quickly identify the most relevant facts of a situation. And as evidence for this theory, he cites the work of a psychologist named John Gutman at the University of Washington, through his years of working with couples, is able to predict with about a 95% accuracy whether couples will stay together. And what's key here is that he's actually able to do this even if he spends as little time as 3 minutes observing a couple interact. It seems the secret to these predictions is in the ratio of positive to negative interactions. Gutman claims that relationships survive if the ratio of positive to negative emotion in a given encounter is at least 5 to 1. And at the same time, he is also looking for what he calls the 4 red flags of troubled relationships: defensiveness, stonewalling, criticism, and contempt. And just by using these 2 measurements, he is able to predict these long-range patterns. We rely on our instincts all the time, and when we do, it seems we're doing something very similar to what Gutman does with couples. We, too, are sifting through a situation and zeroing in on what really matters, and it seems as though our unconscious is actually pretty good at doing this. So keeping in mind the positive-negative ratio for couples, listen to this analysis of improvisational theater, the kind of theater that involves sophisticated decision-making on the spot. Now, while it's true that improvisational theater is unscripted and unrehearsed, the actors in creating it are actually governed by one important rule. And the rule says that the actors must never say no, Somehow, they have to find ways to agree with what's happening, what's just been said just before, in order to have the action continue. So probably not many of us participate in improvisational theater very often, but we're all in relationships of one sort or another, and there's wisdom, I think, in this theater rule of trying to build in a positive way on what's gone on before. Thinking back to the 5-to-1 ratio, what's really happening in those predominantly positive emotional encounters is, on some level, that a kind of constant, almost instinctual yes is being communicated. If the world were divided into those who act more out of instinct and those who tend to deliberate, I know I would fall firmly in the instinctive category. Sometimes I even surprise myself by how much I rely on intuition. Buying my condominium in Newton 12 years ago was, by anyone's standards, a snap decision based on instinct. As I drove east on Watertown Street that spring morning and turned left into the driveway, I knew immediately that this was where I wanted to live. There was something about the entrance, the long stone driveway, the way the house sits on the property, how the trees shade the front porch. And to me, the property had a south of France or north of Italy feel to it. And without even going inside, I knew that I would be happy living there and turning into that driveway every time I came home. I did go inside before I made the offer. But truly, I have spent more time buying a pair of shoes or trying to decide if a cantaloupe was ripe than I did that day. And it turned out to be a good decision. And even though I'm now ready to sell it, I loved living there. Though I will admit that through the years, it has come to feel much more like a house on the eastern edge of West Newton than in the lavender-scented south of France, but that's okay. Learning to trust our inner voice can be a powerful resource in many situations, especially those that are unclear or are meant to be deceptive. I think I've told you that for years before I went into the ministry, I worked as a sex education consultant. I ran workshops for parents and teachers and daycare providers and school administrators. And something we always talked about in those programs was how one of the very best defenses and resources that children have, children of all ages, is learning to trust their own instinct. And I tried hard to teach my own children, if ever someone wanted them to do something or go somewhere or try something that made them uneasy, that didn't feel right or safe to them, that they should trust that feeling and they should say no, and they could say no without having to offer an explanation why. Like the Grecian sculpture debacle, sometimes all we have to go on is a gut feeling, even in the face of evidence to the contrary. And while trusting our inner voice is always a good thing, it's also qualitatively different from making a snap decision. Remember the Hindu parable of the elephant, where everyone touches just one part of the elephant, and then everyone thinks that he or she knows what an elephant is like. It's such a wonderful parable. How often do we see through the limited lens of our own experience? And there's nothing wrong with that. After all, what else do we have to go on? But always we need to remember that there are many lenses, some with perspectives very different from our own, and that the elephant is very large. Here's a delightful and true story of lens viewing. Some of you may know this. Until about 4 decades ago, not so long, Classical music was, for the most part, the preserve of men, because no one believed that women had the strength, the attitude, or the resilience for certain very difficult pieces. Their lips were different, their lungs less powerful, and their hands often appreciably smaller than men's. So when conductors and search committees held auditions, male instrumentalists typically sounded appreciably better than female. And female musicians didn't start sounding as good as their male counterparts until auditions started taking place behind screens, in other words, blind auditions. And when that happened, the number of women in major orchestras increased fivefold. Not surprisingly, women who played brass instruments were the most discriminated against. This would all be interesting theory to me if I hadn't had an experience at Symphony Hall that brought this story home to me. It must have been 4 or 5 years ago. And I found myself sitting next to a woman who had cried throughout the entire first half of the program. And at intermission, I looked at her and smiled what I hoped was a kind of, "It's okay, I cry too" smile. And she told me that she was crying with happiness because this was her first trip to Boston and her first time to Symphony Hall. And she said she felt as though she had come to Mecca. She and her husband had flown up from Florida for this concert because her high school friend was the new tuba player, Mike Royallance, and he had a big part that night. She explained that the two of them had played tuba together all through high school and how thrilling it was for her to now see him with the Boston Symphony. Now imagine what I said. Sensitive, feminist, female. Tuba? That's an unusual instrument for a girl to play. Gladwell says it is just that kind of hidden or not so hidden prejudice that colors and can distort our instincts and instinctual decision making. Musician Herb Websplot says, quote, "The very first time the new audition blind rules were used in the 60s, we were looking for 4 new violinists for the Metropolitan Opera in New York. Out of all the people we auditioned for those 4 positions, the top 4 finalists were all women. That never would have happened if the auditions had not been blind, because up until that point, we only had 3 women in the whole orchestra. I remember," he says, "one of the players was absolutely furious with me for leading the flight for blind auditions and said to me, 'You are going to be remembered as the bad word who brought women into this orchestra.'" While conductors and others who judged non-blind auditions believed they were listening only to the quality of the music, they really were listening through a distorted lens of prejudice and were swayed by unconscious associations they had of women who to them looked too small, too delicate, and too feminine for the job. So that's the caveat that we need to take into account with first impressions. We need to be aware of the unconscious associations that we may bring that distort the reality of what we think we're seeing. You know, what I really wanted to do at the end of the concert that Friday night was to turn to the woman sitting next to me, the woman from Florida, and put my arms around her in a way that said, "I get it. I've shed those same tears for tender memories, for music so beautiful it hurts to hear it, for friends who have left us and moved on, for the thrill of being somewhere you never thought you'd be, for opportunities lost, and for so desperately wanting to savor the joy of the moment. I understand. I know just what you're feeling, because I've been there too." But I didn't. That was my first response, my instinct. But then I deliberated. I didn't know her, and we were in Symphony Hall, for heaven's sake. What would she think? So I didn't, but I wish I had. I believe one of the most meaningful and spiritual aspects of being part of a church community is that it calls on us to widen our lens. It is even a gift of religious community because, as our guest minister last week said, the spiritual life is not intended to be easy. Community is hard work. We realize after the initial honeymoon phase of attending church is over that we may not actually like everyone in the congregation, and that's okay. It's the same for everyone. But here's the gift. It's our community, and we're all in this together. I've learned through the years that the real spiritual work of a small group ministry is not so much in the discussion of the subjects for each meeting, but instead it's in building the trust in the group, in putting judgments aside, in learning how to appreciate or have affection for someone you might not care for or like very much. It is work of the Spirit, and it is good work. It's work that stretches and enlarges our souls. It's the kind of work that is the antithesis of snap decision making. In fact, I think in an odd sort of way, it's a little like blind auditions. So blessed are those who yearn for deepening and who are not afraid to grow in spirit, says John Buren's. Indeed, blessed are we, all of us. So may it be. Amen. In our